starts, what, the first, so the 22nd, roughly 3 weeks from now, Antares will be launching, and I think it's a little after 6 o'clock or 6:30 flight, so we should be able to see the light of the engines low in the horizon in the western horizon. So we'll look forward to that. They have brand new engines. They've scrapped the old engines, the one that blew up. The reason they haven't had any launches of the Antares Cygnus spacecraft is back in October of, was it 2014? That thing blew up about 20 seconds or so after launch and did a lot of damage to Wallops Island Launch Complex. But that's all rebuilt, and they have brand new engines, completely different, much more powerful. They're able to launch a bigger and much heavier Cygnus spacecraft to the space station to resupply it. So looking forward to the Antares launch by Orbital Science. That's the old name. It's Orbital ATK is the company that launches that, private company. That's pretty much it, Dick, for now. Any questions, comments, we'll be here. K2RIW, WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
I just Googled NASA.gov, TESS, and I'm looking for a diagram of that crazy orbit, a 13-day orbit, which is semi-synchronous with the moon's 28-day orbit. And I haven't found that orbit yet. I think you told me the perigee is 60,000 miles. I'm not sure what the apogee is of that orbit. And I presume it's an orbit around the Earth. And I presume its apogee goes a certain distance toward the moon. Is that true, Paul? If it's a 60,000-mile perigee, what was the apogee of that orbit? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, it'll be the moon's orbit, roughly a quarter billion miles, so what's that, 243,000 miles, quarter of a million miles, that would be apogee. And I did come across a NASA site with that orbit. When I find it, I'll send it to you. They had the... They showed the moon, you know, in a forward position, 90 degrees, like in ahead of the spacecraft, when the spacecraft would be all the way out to it, you know, the moon's orbit, and then it comes back and gets, you know, really nowhere near the Earth, 60,000 miles out. But that'll be perigee. And during that time frame, that three-hour time frame when it's close to the Earth, it'll be transmitting all the data that it has acquired during the other, the rest of the 13-day orbit. It'll be looking at the northern hemisphere first. I believe the first 6 months or so, and then it'll switch to the southern hemisphere, that type of thing. Got four big cameras on board, all with, the photo, same type of cameras that Kepler has that looks at nearby, and they're going to look at nearby suns. And I think the number they're looking for is around 200,000 suns, the nearest ones to us. And, of course, the goal is to look for Earth-like planets and eventually turn that over to James Webb Space Telescope.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Time that one out. What'd you miss there?
Okay, the Easter input has come back. I'm making some guesses here, Paul, and correct me on this one. Apogee is 240,000 miles. That's exactly the altitude of the moon. and perigee is 60,000 miles, which is more than twice the altitude of a synchronous satellite. So it's a quite elliptical orbit, and I'm guessing it's set up in such a way. Let me drop. That when TESS satellite is at 240,000 mile apogee, it would be hitting the moon if the moon was there, but the moon's not there. I'm guessing the moon is 90 degrees ahead in its orbit. And then the next time TESS comes around and hits 240,000 mile apogee again, now the moon is 90 degrees behind TESS. And the next time TESS goes down to 60,000 miles, perigee, on the backside of the Earth, that's when the moon occupies its normal position. So it's hopping up to lunar altitude, 90 degrees behind the moon or 90 degrees ahead of the moon. And the only time the perigee and the moon are in the same place is during the time the TESS is going around the backside of the Earth and it's on its perigee, not apogee. Is that approximately the way it does it, Paul? So there's two orbits of TESS for each orbit of the moon, but they're carefully timed, so each time TESS is at apogee, moon altitude, you make sure the moon ain't there. I'm making some guesses here, Paul. I haven't seen the diagram yet. WS2N, K2IW in the TechNet, wait for the beeps.
Okay. Found the audio that I wrote from somewhere. That had to be from, it was either from the NASA site or Goddard. You know, I'm on so many. But, you know, Goddard is you know, in Maryland is going to be the one operating test. So I could probably go back there and find that and send you a copy. But, yeah, it said 13.7 day orbit. So I said 13 and a half. You know, me, I just round everything off. What was the, yeah, the closest point, I said 60,000. Yeah, they have 67,000 miles, and they call it 17 Earth radii. And the highest point, I said 240, yeah, I'm off by 8,000 miles. 232,000 miles will be the official apogee, but, you know, that's roughly the moon orbit. So, and they even give you, for some reason, they give you the radii to that, 58.7 Earth radii. That'll be it. I guess there's some kind of relation between the apogee and perigee. Maybe that's why they give it to me. And radiation belts here from 600, I said 600 miles, and sometimes the radiation belts get up to as high as 37,000, I don't have an exact, 37,282 miles above the surface. That's odd. That would put it, that would involve the geosynchronous satellite. That's odd. All right, back to you, Dick.
But well, I made guesses that the timing of the TESS orbit is such that at apogee, 232,000 miles, it's almost at the lunar orbit altitude. If the moon was there, it would be sucked into the moon. But it's carefully timed so that TESS is at its apogee when the moon is not there. I'm guessing the moon is 90 degrees ahead in its orbit, or 90 degrees behind, each time TESS goes up to apogee. And the only time the moon is at the TESS apogee is during the time the TESS is at perigee. It's on the backside of the Earth at that time. Is that approximately the way it works, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW?
Yeah, that's what I tried to say originally. But you said it better. Yeah, exactly right. To me, it's 90 degrees ahead in the orbit by when TESS is all the way out at apogee. And then 13.7 days later, you're at perigee, and then the moon, is, I guess that would be, wait, the complete orbit, 13.7 days, yeah, every 13.7 days you're back at apogee, so that means that that's one half of an orbit, so that puts the moon 90 degrees ahead, you know, at one point. And then the next time that the test is at apogee, the moon would be 90 degrees behind the test, you know. So, you got it right, Dick. It's trying to explain it is much more difficult than looking at the diagram. I don't have the diagram up. I'll have to find that.
Now, I wonder why they chose in that particular orbit, though. I guess the good news is when it comes down to 60,000 miles, it's close to the Earth and you got a fast data transmitting channel. And when it's at 232,000 miles further from the Earth, you're far away from the Earth and you're a nice clean atmosphere. Now, why is that crazy elliptical orbit that carefully times itself with reference to the Moon, why is that better than, let me pick a number, an orbit that's always 100,000 miles above the Earth? Is there something magic about that orbit that helps them align the spacecraft on their exoplanets that they want to investigate? I mean, other than the fact that the orbit has got a nice high apogee but always misses the Moon, why was that particular orbit chosen then? I wonder if any of the explanations you read about TESS explain why they chose that particular orbit for WS2N, K2IW, and the TechNet.
When I first read the article, probably last year, or maybe the year before, when TESS was being developed, they said that the engineers at Goddard had done extensive research looking for a good stable orbit. They wanted two things mainly. They needed to have it where the spacecraft wasn't going to be affected by anything, where they would hardly need any fuel. They didn't want to go out to L1 or an L2 location. They wanted something where they can come in close, for that reason that you mentioned before, for the ability to transmit a lot of data back down very quickly in a 3-hour period when they got to perigee. And yet they needed a lot of time to be doing science, having these four telescopes at one time staring at different locations in the sky. The idea is to completely cover the whole sky, the nearest 200,000 stars, and there's going to be a lot of data. They did not want to have a big spacecraft with all this fuel and all this complicated stuff to keep the thing stable. And this is one way to do it without going out to L1 or L2. So that's pretty much what I've read. Maybe there's a couple of other reasons I haven't come across yet, but that's it. Back to you, Dick.
You said some magic words there. Four telescopes, and it covers the whole sky. Wow. Okay. How can I make four telescopes cover the whole sky? Are two of them in the upper hemisphere and two of them in the lower hemisphere? I guess I could...
Let me go over that again.
Yeah, go right ahead, Paul.
They have four of them, you know, facing... Well, it looks like the same direction, but, you know, they're at angles to one another, so they're covering a portion of the sky. But don't forget, this is going to take a year. I believe a year for the whole northern hemisphere, and then they'll face it the other way and do a year of the southern hemisphere I think they're doing the northern hemisphere first. So they have the ability to have, instead of, you know, one telescope just looking out, you know, covering a certain beam width, they have four, and they're able to do more at one time. But over a year period of time, they should be able to get a half of hemisphere done. Back to you there.
Okay, so there are four telescopes that look like they're almost parallel to each other, but they're really skewed a little bit. And each one of these telescopes is studying a whole bunch of stars, looking for a planet to transit in front of that star, creating a measurable, very small measurable amount of dimming of that star. And therefore, that gives you a candidate, that either the star has got some kind of a cyclic dimming characteristic, or it really has some planets. And I think it says it's going to look at 200,000 stars all at once. Wow. So I think it's saying for a full year, it's going to be looking at the northern hemisphere, and the next year, it's going to be looking at the southern hemisphere. Let me drop.
Yeah, but $200,000 collectively, not at once.
Okay. Now, as the satellite goes in this quite elliptical orbit, perigee 17 radii, apogee 58 radii, that's a fairly elliptical orbit. Does the satellite still stay aimed at one point in sky during that whole crazy orbit? Back to you on that one. That one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
No, it's gonna be. It'll be looking at different locations as it goes around. You know, how much time they devote to looking in one location, I don't know. But you know, as time goes on, you know, it probably changes from hour to hour, or maybe day to day. I don't have enough details on that. But we'll see. As this thing gets developed, if we get closer to launch, I'm sure there'll be more information coming out on it. Well, I might be able to find some. You know, if you go to the God site, they might have updates on it. I'd like to see a video would be good, you know. That would give you a good idea of what they're doing. Maybe even SpaceX will put something out on it. They're going to be launching it. They hired SpaceX to launch it on a Falcon 9. Back to you, Nick.
Yeah, I see that the Eastern machine is dropping out periodically. Now, one way of using that orbit is always aim the spacecraft away from the Earth. And that's not going to work so well because... with reference to the spacecraft, the Earth appears to sweep very slowly when you're at apogee. When you're at perigee, the Earth seems to sweep very fast. So, if the spacecraft always aimed away from the Earth, you would never be blocked by the Earth, is the good news. But the bad news is periodically you're going to be looking at the sun, and you're going to be sweeping the spacecraft pretty fast. You really want to keep the spacecraft aimed at one point in the sky for as long as possible, as I see it, to do this this eclipsing function of looking at the dimming when something passes in front of that star. So I'm going to guess that the spacecraft tries to aim at one point in the sky continuously, even though it's in this crazy orbit. And for a small portion of that orbit, the telescopes on the spacecraft are looking through the Earth. Oh, wait a minute now. It would only do that... Let me drop this. It would only be looking through the Earth if the telescopes are in the same plane, aimed at the same plane as the orbit. If the telescopes are aimed at the northern hemisphere, due north, for instance, then at no time during the orbit would you be looking through the Earth. So it looks to me like the telescopes are going to be looking at a lot of the northern hemisphere and a lot of the southern hemisphere eventually, but they're going to be avoiding the equator of the celestial sphere, because the equator region is where periodically you're looking at the sun and periodically you're looking at the earth. So I think there's going to be a swath of the equator of the celestial sphere where the telescope never looks in that region. Is that approximately true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Probably not. I guess with the the moon being at a 6-degree tilt in respect to the ecliptic, I think they'll have periods of time where we'll be able to look at the equator. You know, they will be able to move the telescope one place to another. The idea is not to move it that much to save on the amount of fuel that it needs. This way it could be launched at a very high altitude like this and try to keep this spacecraft small. Looks like they have about an 8-foot dish. You know, I'm looking at a picture of the test. And I'm going to guess it's probably about 8-foot diameter. So without moving the telescope, as it goes near the Earth, 60,000 miles away, if they wanted to, I'm sure they could move that telescope and point it at one of the antennas that's going to be doing the receiving for probably a very long time. It's going to probably take quite a few hours, if not maybe almost a half a day to go through the perigee orbit. Let me drop it. They're talking about 3 hours, so my guess is they're not going to be moving the telescope that much. They'll probably just leave it there as it comes around. It will be lined up with the Earth for that 3-hour period. That's what I think is going on. It's an interesting orbit. There's been other highly elliptic satellites that they've used. Chandra satellite goes, its perigee is around 4,000 miles above the Earth. That's where it does all its transmitting. And then it goes all the way out, not to the moon, but out to around 80,000 miles, I think it's 88,000 miles out. So that's highly elliptical, and that's been going operating since the 1990s. This is really something new. There's a P3 orbit, too. Don't ask me what that is, but nobody's used that yet. But they looked at P3. They chose P2. Back to you, Derek.
I'm going to guess P2 stands for period number 2. In other words, the period of the orbit is exactly twice the lunar orbit. And they could have chosen a 3-to-1 ratio between lunar orbit and Earth orbit. That's a guess on my part. So a P2 crazy elliptical orbit between Earth and Moon. I'm going to guess, Paul, that the test satellite is primarily powered by solar panels, photovoltaic, and I'm going to guess that they've got little waving objects on the end of the solar panels that, depending on how you wave them, they collect solar wind to do orientation. So therefore, you don't have to put power into inertial wheels or reaction control jets in order to do orienting. I think they discovered that on the Kepler 2 mission, let me drop. I think they discovered that they can wave these tail feathers, so to speak, to do orienting. And I'm going to guess that TESS is going to be doing a lot of its orienting by waving little panels at the tips of the solar panels, which do the orienting using the pressure of the solar wind. Has that been mentioned, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, I don't see any kind of pieces coming off the end of the solar panels. The solar panels are very short. There's two square panels coming out on one side and two square panels coming out on the other side. So they're not very long. So if the whole diameter, let's see, if the whole diameter is probably, I'm going to call it 14 feet, maybe a little less. That would make the panels, I would say seven, probably 6 foot squares, two on one side, two on the other. So it looks like they only extend about 12 feet out from the spacecraft itself. But I guess it's enough power to do what they have to do. So, the P2, I was saying that earlier, that P2 stands for period, so for every time the moon goes around in one orbit, Tesla will go around two. And it's the first time they've used it. They only investigated the P2 orbit back in the early 1990s, and they were thinking about it for some science mission, but they thought it wouldn't work out. But it's only now that they really have decided that this looks like a real good orbit for this type of mission. Back to you, Dick.
Now, you didn't see any little tail feathers that are orientable on the end of the solar panels as a way of using solar wind and the drag of the solar wind as a way of doing orienting. I'm going to make another guess. You got two square panels coming out of the starboard side, two square panels coming out of the port side of the spacecraft. If you slightly change the angle between the two panels so that they're not out flat, you can change the amount of projected area. Therefore, the solar wind hitting those panels will slightly change the orientation of the spacecraft. So you can either do it with little tail feathers, or you can slowly change the orientation of the four panels you've got in order to do some steering. I wonder if they've said anything along those lines, Paul. What is the main method that the spacecraft keeps its pointing in space accurate? Is it inertial wheels? Is it reaction control jets? The reaction control jets are the least desirable way because you're using a consumable fuel when you do that. And the good news about using inertial wheels is all you got to do is take the electrical power from the solar panels and apply it to those wheels, and you can get what you desire. However, the history of Hubble, for instance, has been a lot of those repair missions are replacing those inertial wheels that the bearings on them seem to wear out. So how is TESS really doing the majority of its very precise orienting so it aims at the right point in space for some extended period of time? WS2N, K2RIW.
You know, maybe that's why they chose this design. You know, it looks like two wings sticking out instead of the Kepler mission. You know, they took the solar panels and covered the body of the spacecraft. There weren't out wings on that. And I think they would have had a better job using the solar wind to control the spacecraft if they had wings. They're doing it, you know, they're balancing the spacecraft, essentially the two of the panels that come together. They're using that, you know, that angle. It's not a 90, but, you know, they're using that angle to balance the spacecraft. This is a better design if they get into that situation. Or maybe that's the way it's done. I mean, they look at it. I got a close-up of it. It looks like the panels could be actuated. And I know they usually would want to do that for better viewing of the sun. So it wouldn't be too hard to do the same actuation of those panels to use the solar wind to keep it steady. Or maybe that's what they're doing. A little bit of both, you know, face the panels toward the sun, pick up the sunlight, and use the solar panels for controlling flight orientation. But who knows? I don't know yet. We'll have to see. It might have momentum wheels. I haven't read anything about it yet, though. I look for it, especially at the Kepler 2. Kepler 2, that's why we have a Kepler 2. Kepler 1, the first part of that mission.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You need three to go. You had four of them on board. One was the backup, two failed, and that was it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, every time I see a picture of Kepler, all of its solar panels look like they're essentially flat against the outer circular tube of the spacecraft. And from what you're now saying, I guess those solar panels on Kepler can be slightly reoriented. Is that how Kepler 2 is operating? It's reorienting its solar panels and using the solar wind in order to give precise pointing of Kepler. So give us some words as to how Kepler 2 is doing its orienting now that it only has two of the required three inertial wheels. Over to you, Paul, K2IW.
Well, if you took a soda can and just covered three sides of the can, you know, with solar panels, flat solar panels, that's the way it is. So the solar panels don't move on Kepler, but not Kepler 2. They cannot be oriented. But what they're doing now is they're taking two of the panels, the edge of it, and pointing it directly at the sun. And the solar wind is hitting two of those panels, let's say two of those three panels, in such a way that, you know, the pointy part of it, where the two panels come together, is facing the sun. So that's what they're doing. They're balancing it on that. So, yeah, they move the spacecraft in such a way to get that kind of location for that. For that little balancing act to occur. I'm sure if they would have thought that these momentum wheels weren't going to last, if they were, you know, unfortunately they failed, but, you know, I'm sure an afterthought in their head would be to make these solar panels sticking out like this one. This is a good design. They'd have that option with this.
Okay, so of the three solar panels that are on Kepler, the apex of two of them is being aimed at the sun. So that way you're getting raw stabilization. And I'm going to guess now that the remaining two inertial wheels are giving you pitch and yaw stabilization. So the roll stabilization is being done by aiming the apex of two panels at the sun. Is that approximately what's going on with Kepler 2? Over to you, Paul, K2IW.
Yeah, yep, that makes up for the failed two inertial wheels. Like I said, it went with four. They always had one as a backup. One failed, and then the other one failed. So now they have two left. They use the solar panels to replace the third one. But see, because of that, you know, that did away with the Kepler 1 first mission. their whole mission was to point the telescope, you know, toward one location, toward the Cygnus constellation, and pick out, I think it was 150,000 stars in one location, and just stare at them like forever, and look for planets that way. This is going to be much better. It's going to be looking for the closest 200,000 stars instead of being, you know, countless light years away. This thing will be, you know, in our own ballpark, you might say. Not at the other end, you know, halfway across the galaxy. Back to you, Dick.
Did the Kepler-1 mission have an aperture disc? In other words, you had this disc in front of the telescope or behind the telescope that had a whole bunch of holes in it. And the holes were oriented toward the stars that you were staring at. And you had a fiber optic cable coming from each one of those holes going into a detector. There was what kind of a telescope that does that? And then I remember seeing the pictures of the focal plane array of charge-coupled devices, is I think what they are. So another way of looking at it is that the telescope takes all of those stars in the Kepler-1 mission and just aims at the camera, so to speak. So I guess there really is no aperture with a bunch of holes. They've done that on some of the ground-based telescopes. But I guess that's to get rid of the flare light that you get because of the sky, the atmosphere. In space, you don't have to do that. So there is no aperture with holes that the telescope is looking through with Kepler. That's what I've slowly concluded, and maybe you'll confirm that for me, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, that was the Gaia mission we talked about, G-A-I-A, I think it was the Gaia mission by European Space Agency. And they sent that out on to a L2 location as well. So L2 being Sun, Earth, satellite. And that mission isn't working out too good. About a year ago I don't think they were getting the results that they expected, but that had some kind of a mask type of setup with all these charge-coupled devices, just so they could look at a whole bunch of stars at the same time. I remember that had it. Whether Kepler had anything like that or similar to it, I don't remember. This one might have it. I'll have to look for that as well. I wouldn't be surprised if this thing had it. Test. But I haven't seen that yet. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I should have remembered the Lagrange point. Lagrange point number one, I think, is the point roughly a million miles away from the Earth toward the Sun. I think Lagrange point number two is roughly a million miles away from the Earth on the opposite side of the Sun. Lagrange point 3 and 4, I think, are 60 degrees ahead and 60 degrees behind our orbit around the Sun. So, and is there a fifth? I think there's a fifth Lagrange point, which is on the back side of the Sun. So, Lagrange 1 is toward the Sun, a million miles from Earth, and Lagrange 2 is away from the Sun, a million miles away from the Earth, on the back side of the Earth. Is that roughly true, Paul? K2LIW?
Yeah, I think I heard two different... I think you got 5 and 3 backwards. I think you had it right first time, then you threw a 5 in it. You have... Lagrange's... One is Sun. Then you have the spacecraft. And then you have the Earth. So that would be like where Discover is, that SpaceX sent out on a Falcon 9. That would be where ACE is, the solar detecting spacecraft. And that would be where SOHO is. That's been out there forever. That's a combined mission between NASA and the European Space Agency. A million miles out. So you got Sun, spacecraft, Earth, And then Lagrange point two, you have the sun, Earth, and then a million miles past the Earth. And that's where you have spacecraft like Planck and Herschel, and they're not functioning anymore. You have Gaia out there, and that's where you're going to have James Webb Space Telescope sitting out a million miles past the Earth. So that would be sun, Earth, and spacecraft. That's L2. L3, there's no spacecraft. We have no use for that. That's on opposite side of the sun. But that would be a stable orbit. Let me drop it. And then you have the L4, not as stable. You need a little bit more fuel to stay in L4. That would be set up an equilateral triangle between the sun and the Earth, and then, you know, in front of us, in front of the orbit of the direction that we're traveling. That would be 4, and then 5 would be the exact same thing, except behind us. And that's why you have the Trojan asteroid out near Jupiter. They, you know, each planet has this L system as well, these Lagrange points too. So you have a bunch of Trojan asteroids located in the L4 location of Sun, Jupiter, and then these asteroids are all pumped together. That would be a popular location for where they want to put eventually in the future a colony living near the moon. Let me drop it. Because we have Lagrange points between for the moon as well. So they want to eventually have a theoretical town built floating in space at the L4 position for between us and the moon. So you might see that come up if you're around 100 years from now. Back to you, Dick.
I think you lost the east. I'm hearing the east right now. It drops out periodically and it comes back. So east is there right now. Are you confirming that, John? Go ahead.
Yes, it just came back a couple of seconds ago.
And so, does east disappear because we time it out a little bit sooner than this repeater? And as long as we drop this repeater, east comes back. When we come back on, is that approximately what you're seeing, John? Go ahead.
E2WG, it seems to be erratic, Dick, and I know Eric knows about it, but he's not sure what it could be until he examines it, but I'm not sure. It's too erratic.
Contact. So it's not just a simple timeout problem. Was that you, Eric, saying something? I'm only hearing the tail end of a word. Somebody is saying something. Go ahead.
KD2FIU is asking a question. Contact, please.
Okay, I think somebody wants to ask a question, so we'll stand by for that question. Go right ahead, sir.
Yes, I've spoken with some of you folks before. This is KD2FIU, George. As listening, just an answer to a question here, as in perspective, the sun at approximately 93 million miles, and the moon at approximately, what will we call, 156,000 miles. Is that a confirmation as we go along, Dick?
Yeah, good question, George. The Earth going around the sun is a slightly elliptical orbit, but it averages rather close to 93 million miles, and frequently that's called one astronomical unit. The moon has a slightly elliptical orbit where it's closer and further away, but a rough rule of thumb, the moon's average distance from the Earth is in the vicinity of 240,000 miles. So center of Earth to center of moon averages something close to 240,000 miles, maybe it's 238, but it's in that neighborhood. So, as you can tell, the moon is a hell of a lot closer to the Earth than the sun. The sun is almost 360 million miles. I mean, let me think now. A quarter of a million versus 93, 4 times 93. There's almost a 300-to-1 ratio between lunar distance and sun distance. So you could say the moon is about 300 and some odd times closer to us. So around 238 or 240,000 miles is the approximate lunar distance, center of Earth to center of moon. KD2FIU, K2RIW, go ahead, George.
Thank you, Dick. That was good, because I remember the 93, but I couldn't get the exact on the moon, so I'm sitting here letting it revolve, and thank you for the confirmation. KD2FIU, standing by.
Comment, Dick, WS2N.
Go right ahead, Paul. I correct my numbers.
You're very close, but it's an interesting phenomena that we have with the eclipses, because it's really like one.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
From the moon equals the sun. And because the diameter of the sun is about 400 times the diameter of the moon, that's why it just so happens to work out that the eclipses are almost perfect, where, you know, when the moon moves in front of the sun, you know, everything gets dark here. And if the moon was, you know, half the size as it is now, if the sun was twice as big, it would look different. You know, you wouldn't get that complete blackout appearance if the moon was half the size. So it's just an interesting phenomenon. It's around 400-to-1 in both the, you know, direction and diameter.
All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of a kind of a telescope. SOHO is one of them, where it puts an aperture in front of the picture that blocks out the sun. The sun is so darn bright, you got to block it out. Otherwise, you overload your camera. What's the name of that kind of a telescope where you block out that bright object? All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of it. Over to you, Paul.
The Chrono, when they put that in front, is that what you're just talking about? When they put a big black circle or something like that in front of the telescope to create an eclipse?
Yeah, maybe it's called a coronagraph. Now, to simply put a black object in front of the telescope to block out the sun, it sounds like that should give you a beautiful picture without the sun overloading the camera. I think that's what a coronagraph is. But there's a catch. And the catch is you always have knife-edge diffraction around the sharp edges of your black object. You're going to get some light crawling around that edge. The only way you can really avoid that problem is to put your solar-blocking object a very long distance away from the telescope. If you could mount that object a million miles away from the telescope and have it just the right diameter, you'd get a beautiful picture. Well, that's what the moon does. The moon is a quarter of a million. Let me drop.
There's a planned mission to do that, Dick.
Absolutely. And that planned mission, that aperture-blocking object, has got a really weird shape to it. If this is the best of all worlds, you've mounted a million miles away from your telescope. Well, that's such a long distance, and it requires such precise aiming and orientation, it's much too difficult to do. So instead of putting it a million miles away, you put it, let me pick a number, 100,000 miles away, and you make this very fancy scalloped edges on your aperture blocking thing, which almost cancels this knife edge diffraction you get around the perimeter. What is knife edge diffraction? You can put a razor blade in front of your face, hold it at the arm's length, and you've got an extremely sharp point of light in a dark room. And as you carefully orient that razor blade toward that light, and you think you're going to completely block out the light, you look at that razor blade, and the sharp edge of the razor blade will look like it's lit up, knife-edge diffraction. There's some funny characteristic of where a sharp edge, a little bit of the light bends around that sharp edge. Let me drop. And so whenever you've got a aperture-blocking device, you've got to worry about that phenomenon. So therefore, a simple coronagraph where you put a blocking device in front of the camera to make it block out exactly the diameter of the sun is very difficult. If you take a look at the photographs done with SOHO, you realize that the blocking device is about twice the diameter of the sun. Because if they didn't do that, the knife-edge diffraction around the edge would overload the camera. So they've sacrificed some of the outer fringes of the sun in order to get rid of the knife-edge diffraction problem. But the moon does a beautiful coronagraph because it is a million miles away. And the little bit of light that crawls around the edge of the moon is so far away it gives you very little problem. So it's overly coincidental, so to speak. Let me drop. Where the sun has an apparent diameter extremely close to one half of a degree, roughly 30 minutes of arc. The moon has a diameter very close to 30 minutes of arc, a half a degree. So now, depending on whether the moon in its particular orbit happens to be at perigee, which gives you a beautiful total eclipse, or an apogee, where it now gives you a partial eclipse. What do they call that now? I can't think of the name of it. Annular. And you get in other words, you start seeing around the edge of the moon. You will see the sun when the moon happens to be at apogee. But if the moon happens to be in perigee, then you get a complete blockage. So a total eclipse only occurs when the moon is at apogee. Let me drop it. In August of the year 2017, there is going to be a total eclipse that sweeps across the whole darn United States. It starts off somewhere near Oregon and sweeps across the United States, exiting somewhere around North Carolina, as I remember. So there's a whole lot of people setting up their vacation time right now, so they're going to be at some place where they believe they're going to have a clear sky in August of 2017, one of these really good solar eclipses that sweeps across the United States. So coronagraph is the word I was looking for, and no coronagraph is required with the TESS because it's not going to be looking toward the sun. Only a SOHO needed a coronagraph, and it's a compromised coronagraph because of this knife-edge diffraction. I wonder if that's ever been explained in any of the articles you've read, Paul. WS2N, Space Report, K2LIW and TechNet.
This is WS2N, and the coronagraph. There is a coronagraph mission plan, it's on the drawing boards, and they would like to put this thing thousands of miles away from the viewing telescope, and it's as you described with all these pointy different things. It's not a round disc, and they would, you know, the complicated part, of course, would be to open up this disc or coronagraph. And what's entailed in doing something like that, because they said it would have to be gigantic. So that's one of the things that they are considering for a future next telescope type of, you know, I remember reading probably back in the late 1980s, probably right after Hubble was launched, they talked about the next generation telescope. Well, that's the one that's going to be launched. It's called the James Webb Space Telescope next September 2018. Now they always talk about the next generation telescope, and this is one of the things that they were talking about, a coronagraph type of setup. We'd have two launches, one with the telescope and one with this coronagraph that would open up far, far away. That's pretty much it, Dick. I covered all the topics I wanted to cover, including the tiles that are going to be put onto the Orion spacecraft. Now I don't hear the Eastern link. Back to you, Dick.
The good news is I'm hearing. Yep, I'm hearing the Eastern link. It's coming and going, but it's there. 90% of the time. There's a number of YouTube videos talking about the next generation of LIGO, the laser interferometer gravity detector, gravity observatory, and they're thinking of putting a number of objects in a triangular pattern in space. See, LIGO would be more sensitive to lower frequency gravitational waves if it had a longer arm to it. I think it's 4 kilometers long. Each of the arms now are 4 kilometers long, and two of them are at a right angle. And if you could have made that 40 miles long, you'd have a lot more sensitivity to lower frequency gravitational waves. So, one of the proposals is to build a LIGO-like device in space. I bet you've seen some articles on that stuff, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yes, that's the fact that we talked about that a couple of times. I brought that up. The LISA mission is out there now, and the European Space Agency launched that, and that's out at L1 position, and it took probably 4 or 5 months to get there. And that's a demonstration type of test. They've got these solid spheres, two of them inside of a spacecraft, you know, with a perfect vacuum floating around, and trying to keep it where the two are exactly lined up with one another. They have to keep lasers in there detecting the locations. Make a long story short, it worked out that these two floating objects are not being interfered by the solar wind or anything because they're inside the spacecraft. The spacecraft has little tiny thrusters on it, which is keeping it, you know, keeping the spheres away from the walls of the inside of the spacecraft. But the two spheres themselves are staying perfectly aligned. So they needed to do this to see if the capability was there, if it was possible. And it came out 5 times better than what they thought. Now this is, you know, mission number one. Mission number two won't happen until probably 2030 or 2031, where they plan on launching a mission, like you said, where the three spacecraft would be a million miles apart from one another, and they would do the same type of thing. Keep these cubes inside of the spacecraft, but measured between them exactly. And if a gravitational wave comes by,
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel. Net time complete.
You knew when the drop out occurred, Paul. Are you running full duplex mode? You seem to know now when the drop out occurs.
Yeah, I have it on in the background, but unfortunately, a lot of times I'm transmitting. I must be overwhelming the sensitivity of the HT. So sometimes it's kicking out, but not because of the timeout, but because of me. So I might have to find a different way to reorient that HT, or, you know, I'm not going to put a cavity filter in or anything. But you know, that would be the way to go, I guess. Back to you, Dick.
I'm also keying up to release that, Dick.